How do prominent court cases influence our understanding of human behavior? When lawyers get their hands on science and present it to a jury in life-or-death cases, and the results get offered up in wild and distorted headlines, does the truth get tossed out the window? That's the fear as a jury deliberates the fate of Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Will he get life in prison or the death penalty? During the trial, Tsarnaev's defense team presented all sorts of mitigating factors against the death penalty, including that as a 19-year-old, Tsarnaev had an immature adolescent brain not fully capable of effective reasoning and decision-making, and especially open to the radicalizing influence of his late older brother, Tamerlan. Dr. Sally Satel, a psychiatrist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, is co-author of the book Brainwashed: The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. She says in this case, lawyers have stretched reality trying to turn mercy for a convicted killer into a matter of brain science.
The key to remember is that neuroscience has its place, and especially functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, it has a very secure place in the lab and to some extent in the clinic. It's when it migrates into the public square that things sometimes get a little bit overstated, or frankly, a lot overstated. And one of those domains into which neuroscience has migrated is the courtroom.
So do you begrudge the defense for grabbing at anything that would save him? Is it scientifically invalid to just kind of throw the kitchen sink at the jury?
I certainly don't begrudge his strategists for doing that. But there are clearly people with deficiencies in their brain that make it extremely difficult for them to conform their behavior because of those problems. The question is, can brain imaging in the courtroom identify those people? And the answer is no. Even though they may be introduced, the answer is ultimately that it cannot show that unless the injury is just massive and also probably very acute. Take, for example, the case of Andrea Yates. It was the woman in 2001 in Houston who drowned her 5 children in the bathtub. She had a severe postpartum psychosis. She thought she was the devil, that she was infecting her children, that she had to kill them in order to save them. And she did. And then after she drowned them and lined them up on the bed, she called the police. And ultimately, she was declared not guilty by reason of insanity, which I certainly believe was the correct disposition. But at that time, there was no brain scan used in her defense. But had there been a brain scan taken at that time, chances are it wouldn't have shown anything particularly abnormal. Now, that's not because there wasn't something desperately abnormal with her brain, but either the instrumentation at the time right now is not sensitive enough to pick that up, various reasons. But the point is that it works both ways, that we can find things in the brain. For example, there was a famous case of in the late 90s, of an executive in New York who pushed his wife out a window after he killed her, and to make it look like a suicide. And then in desperation, his lawyers thought, well, let's just send him for a brain scan. Maybe we can find something. And sure enough, they actually found a large, what was called subarachnoid cyst in his, his right orbital frontal lobe. And that seemed incredibly compelling. The scan showed this huge black void, and around it was compressed tissue. So his lawyers made the argument that the compressed tissue somehow made it impossible for him to understand the difference between right and wrong. And it actually turned out that this cyst was a completely incidental finding. And that what that means is that it didn't alter his behavior at all in any dimension. This doesn't mean that we won't get much better at using brain-based data, but right now it's still at a pretty primitive stage.
It just means that something that looks visually compelling may be persuasive to a jury, but it's dangerous to be out there in the public as some sort of a theory that might apply to other cases.
That's exactly right. In fact, the prejudicial significance of these scans has concerned some judges to the point where they won't let the defense show the scans, or they can describe them, for example. But remember, again, this is when we talk about the teen brain, basically we're talking about the fact that the frontal lobe, which is an area associated with planning and control and inhibition, the fibers that it sends to another area of the brain that's involved with excitation and fear and aggression, that those inhibiting fibers haven't yet completely finished developing. So that could lead to a kind of disposition towards impulsivity. And then another part of the brain that modifies reward and motivation. And in teens, it's more sensitive than in adults. And the idea there is that it makes sensation seeking and the desire of peer approval an even more compelling prospect for teens.
And so the takeaway here would be maybe it's okay to theorize that his brother's influence on him, a phenomenon that is well established in psychological literature, could have had something to do with this crime. Whether or not it excuses him or not is another thing. And whether or not you need some kind of fancy brain imaging evidence to enhance that theory is crossing a line and may be irresponsible as far as evidence in the courtroom is concerned. Is that about right?
Yes, I think it is an overstatement. I have no question that his brother did influence him significantly. The question is, was he able to reason and was he able to control himself? And there is nothing about the teen brain in general that indicates that a person is bereft of those faculties.
Sally Satel is a psychiatrist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She's co-author of a book called Brainwashed: The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.